Was it spread from animals to people, or what? That's my question. Back to Net. This is N2HVR.
Hey, Nick. Well, ultimately, no one knows for sure. Probably because the coronavirus jumped to a human host probably about 3 weeks before anyone took the trouble of really investigating what was going on. Coronaviruses are a class of viruses usually seen in wild animals. So there was some talk of it from a bat and others from a snake. There was a large wet market in Wuhan that traded in all manner of wild animals. So it's very likely that one of these wild animals was carrying a whole bunch of different coronaviruses, and one that had mutated just enough to be able to jump species, and it took off like nobody's business. So that's probably where it comes from, but I don't know if we'll ever be able to tell you for sure that it came from a diseased bat versus a diseased snake. It didn't come out of nowhere from a human being, because human beings usually do not suffer from coronaviruses, with the exception of SARS back in 2002, 2003, and MERS. There have been these little mini outbreaks, and those have been far less infectious. They were more deadly, but they were far less infectious than this particular version of coronavirus.
Can it spread from human to animal?
Actually, I have a little article that basically discusses that. The short version of the answer is, humans can give it to animals. You can give it to a dog. It doesn't cause a serious disease in the dog. Dogs can't really transmit it, as far as doctors are concerned. They're not even quite sure if they actively are infected or if they're just contaminated with their owner's viral shedding.
CIS query.
Yes, Bill.
Me, that in looking at the coronavirus numbers in the U.S., that there's a doubling rate approximately every 3 days. We have twice as many confirmed cases as before. And it's been that way for, I think, a couple of weeks. So that indicates to me that it seems completely uncontained in the United States. That's my question. And then a comment on Italy. My understanding was that, that Italy has a very aging population, and that accounted for the high mortality rate for them. Also, another comment, there's apparently a woman researcher in Singapore. I don't know what the reality is, but she seems, quote-unquote, 90% sure that this current coronavirus jumped species from bats. From a live bat to a live human, AC2IS.
This is not the first I've heard. Bat is a very popular option because bats do carry coronaviruses. And these viruses are thankfully not resilient enough to last too long out of living hosts. So just statistically, it's more likely it went from living to living rather than a dead bat or a dead snake. But again, I don't know if they're going to be able to piece things together at this point enough to say definitively that it came from a bat to a human being. For all we know, it could have gone from a bat to a snake to a human being. There could have been an intermediary. I've heard of cases of that. Unfortunately, the infection rate in the United States is scary as heck. Because we haven't really done a great deal. It's not sufficient, unfortunately, to close the borders. because the virus is already here. You can slow it down a little bit. You can help around the edges, but it's not going to make any dramatic differences. As I mentioned last week in Washington State, they did some genetic drifting tests with the virus and realized it had been around Washington for a good 6 weeks before anyone noticed. So it's been sitting and simmering, and most people probably are either not very lightly symptomatic or asymptomatic, or they think it's just the influenza virus, and so it doesn't light up their mind about these things. And it's only those people, the 20 or 10% that have severe enough symptoms that warrant extensive studies that have that get the test. As I said, there's only been 16,000 tests in the entirety of the United States. It's somewhat semi-ridiculous. You have to know your enemy before you can do anything about it. And right now, the plan has, the strategy has shifted from containment to slowing the pace down, if you will. The term that the epidemiologists are talking to everyone about is what they call flattening the curve. In other words, for the most part, you kind of accept that the area under the curve is going to be unchanged no matter what you do, although hopefully if we get our act together, we can decrease the area of the curve. But they're primarily looking to flatten the curve so that it doesn't peak at any time where it overflows our health care facilities, and we can't manage the number of sick people at that one time.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
To catch this, you know, let's not say somebody's 3 feet away and they cough. You know, what does it take to get into your system? Suppose you get just like one little, you know, virus, one teeny tiny virus in it. Is that enough to, you know, to change your whole system? Or if somebody coughs very strongly and you get, you know, thousands of these little molecules in your system at one time, thousands of little viruses at one time, is it more likely that person's going to come down with something? You know, and I would assume the inverse square law is in effect too. If you go from, you know, 1 meter to 2 meters, you're going to get, you know, four times less of a chance of getting the virus. What do you think, Roy? Back to you.
AC2GS, by the way. According to epidemiologists, the magic number that they've pulled out of someplace or other is either 2 meters or 6 feet, depending upon the way you like to measure things. It's an arbitrary number. As you mentioned, just spatially, the droplets will get less and less, and there's a chance more likely that they'll fall anyway. So they drop out probably better than 1 over R squared. So they say six feet away. Most of the transmission is primarily through droplets. The droplets usually have thousands upon thousands of viral particles on them. So if you get hit by a little spittle or sneeze or cough, you're getting probably 1,000. If it lands in your mucous membranes, they go to work, they invade it because they're designed for it, and they make a home, and they make you know, hundreds of thousands of copies, and those shed, and it goes on and on and on, and it works its way around your oral pharynx mucosa, and in some cases it tracks down to your lungs, and that's where you get the pneumonia. One of the things that the Chinese apparently were doing before, I guess, they had a lot of test kits, is if you had symptoms bad enough, apparently they have these mobile CAT scan devices, and they just rolled them up, and they were able to do a person every 15 minutes, which is semi-bizarre for us. But every 15 minutes, they would look for the ground glass changes in the CAT scans of the lungs. And if the people were symptomatic enough, they would go into some kind of isolation hospital. And if they weren't, they would end up in a hotel that was just set aside for people with the infection. They wouldn't let them go back and self-isolate. They wouldn't let them go back to family. And in some cases, the Chinese were supposed to make it a little draconian for us. So we can't kind of pull that nonsense. I'm deeply concerned by the fact that the Mass Transit Authority, I understand why they don't want to close it, but I can see that as a major vector of the disease in New York City, but I guess they figure that they have no choice.
AC Joyous, comment.
Yes, Bill.
WGB.
Bill first, and then Rich second. So, Bill, you had a comment to make.
Rich. So it seems that the mortality rate is very uncertain. And, you know, people have said numbers as low as 1%, numbers as high as 4%. There's a lot of people that have said 2%. There are reasons to think that these numbers are high. Seems to be our big hope right now. It make the doubling rate for the number of confirmed cases, which is probably behind where things really are because our testing is so poor. But I make that doubling rate is something like 3 days. And if that, I don't think that doubling rate can possibly be maintained for very long. Right? If the doubling rate continues like that for 28 doubling periods, that's roughly it'll hit the number of people in the country in something like 80 days. So I would think that there would have to be some flattening of the curve there because the virus, long before it hit that maximum number, would have difficulty finding new people to infect, right? All the quote-unquote nearby people would have been infected already, and there would be some herd immunity kicking in already. I don't know, how does that number sound to you? Is it possible that it could really run through the entire country in something like 3 months? And if it can, is that something of a good news kind of thing? Because I think it's every 14 days, maybe, the virus changes a single letter of its DNA code. And in 3 months, even if we call it 6 months, it should not be able to mutate quickly enough to be able to reinfect people, right? It would be recognized as the same thing, and people who had been exposed to it already would have been immunized against it already. Does that thought process sound correct to you, ACTIS?
Yes, Bill. It sounds perfectly sane to me. There's some degree of genetic drift, but over a couple of months, I don't think it's going to be significant enough to affect a person's ability to immunologically fight off an infection that they already had. And I have heard quotes as high as 30% of the population to 50% of the population will end up testing positive serology for infection of this virus when the dust settles. The idea, to a degree, is to flatten the curve so that it doesn't peak too high ever, and that we don't run out of respirators and hospital beds, because the overwhelming majority will just not feel terribly well, and that's about all that'll happen to them. It's the minority that we're concerned a great deal about. And again, we don't know. They say 20% or 10%. The mortality rate you mentioned, the World Health Organization came out March 3rd with this 3.4, which sounds very high to me. At that time, epidemiologists were saying that they are expecting it to be something in the way of say about 0.65, I think, was the magic number. And lately I've heard epidemiologists downplay even that and say they think it's going to settle down to a 0.5 mortality. But, you know, I mean, that's still, as I said before, five times more fatal than the common influenza that hits us every winter. So that's not great, but if we can delay the inevitable and stretch it out over a longer haul, then we can have more than enough healthcare professionals to manage this, and most people will get out of the tunnel the other end just as well as they went into the tunnel.
Richard, it sounds like you're agreeing, or at least not objecting to the thought that we got a doubling rate of every 3 days. It does not seem to me that at that kind of a doubling rate that testing is going to be able to jump ahead of the numbers that the virus has. We would have to, start testing everyone very soon. And potentially testing people multiple times, which it seems like we just don't have the capacity to do. And on top of, let's say that the quote-unquote mortality rate is, quote-unquote, 0.5, or, if you have people who can access good health care, I think the numbers are going to be larger of people who are in, quote-unquote, critical condition. And, if this doubling rate really goes this way, I don't see how there could be capacity in hospitals to account for that. AC2IS.
Well, again, it sort of depends upon the rate of growth. Now, my gut feeling, and by the way, my name is Roy, not Rich. My gut feeling with the rate of infected people is that the slope's going to actually go up when they get these damn kits out there, because they're going to start testing relatives and contacts of people who've already tested positive. And I think that's going to put a short jump up. And sort of the same thing happened if you look at the curve in China. There was a point where the slope wasn't that terrible, and then in one day it kind of jumped up because they had a similar type of phenomena. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if there's a sudden jump up when the state health facilities are flooded with these test devices. And then it will smooth out again to a degree. And we just have to limit, social isolation and limit interaction. There will come a point, as you mentioned, herd immunity, where if everyone around you already has the virus, you're not going to give it to them. They're not going to give it to you. So it sort of burns out in low patients as long as you don't randomize your population excessively. So hopefully during this period of time, there'll be less people traveling all over the heck, and more social isolation. So hopefully we'll flatten the curve so that the area may not shrink, but at least it won't peak high enough that we run out of respirators. There's very few respirators in this country. There's 160,000 ventilators, according to places that I trust their numbers. And I think there's a supplementary storage of maybe 60,000, just in case. And then you have to worry about the respiratory therapist, because you need people to operate this equipment. This is not like a computer. This is not like a vacuum cleaner. You need to be trained for it. So we'll have to see what happens. But it's possible that we could flatten it enough and slow it down enough so that we can handle it, and we don't hear these horror stories that we are hearing from Italy of doing combat triage on patients.
Roy, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
This herd immunity sounds like you described a pyramid scheme. That's just the way it works. you run out of people.
It's not that you run out of people. It's that the non-random nature of the universe, thankfully, you tend to isolate those people who are capable of getting the infection around other people who've already built up an immunity. So they're not going to get it from anyone, and they're not going to give it to anyone. So it kind of puts the brakes on things. It's why, you know, I think I described this a couple of weeks ago, how, you know, people went a little crazy with the AIDS epidemic. They would draw these terrible curves, and you can see the same type of curves today with the coronavirus, that it's an exponential increase. So if you do it on a logarithmic table, it's a straight line going all the way up, which means that the number of people is increasing exponentially, which is god awful. But you reach a point where you can't feed the virus anymore. It's either killing people, or it's causing them to be isolated, or it's impacting their existence in other ways, and that's when there's a cap, and then it starts to dip down. And, you know, if you look at most epidemiological studies of most viruses, most infections, that's what you tend to see. You see a little bumpy rise to a peak, and it peaks, it turns over, and then it's a little bumpy on the way down, but it goes down. Unfortunately, there are some cases where there are double peaks and triple peaks. The Spanish flu of 1917 to 1920 had a really bad double peak. It was very bad, and then the summer came, and it faded away, and then the fall came, and it came back like gangbusters, worse than the first. So, you know, there's a little variation, but thankfully we haven't come across any kind of virus or bacteria or plague that kills us all. So we will survive. It'll knock the hell out of the stock market. It'll knock the hell out of most of our lifestyles for a while, but we'll come out of the tunnel the other end.
Whiskey 2, Bravo.
Yes, Rich, what's your question?
Roy, this can survive on cardboard, and I immediately thought of all the UPS drivers. If you have a UPS driver that has it, and thing all over the boxes and truck, and then handing them to people, somebody doesn't pick one up for an hour or so, and grabs the, I mean, can, if this can, you know, be transmitted on box, cardboard boxes, that could be problematic, couldn't it?
Yes, indeed. And when I got a UPS package the other day, I think he left it on the porch. About an hour or two later, I picked it up. I brought it to the house, put it down on the floor, and walked over to the bathroom and washed my hands for 20 seconds, and I'm leaving it age for a day or so. Call me a little paranoid.
Now, I have two pause for thought here about how quickly you do go and up my package, or maybe, what about rubber gloves? Would they help in situations like that?
To a degree, if you put the rubber gloves on and touch the things that you shouldn't touch, and then gingerly take the gloves off without touching any part of the gloves that touch something, then you can have probably serves the same purpose as just going into the kitchen or the bathroom and washing your hands for 20, 30 seconds.
And I wouldn't think it's so powerful as to be able to penetrate from the outside of the box to the box that contains your goodies that you've been loosely from. I wonder if that would be true. And second, and I've never heard this question asked, not that it's such a fabulous question, is there anything positive that could come home when said?
Okay, Rich, you broke up with the last question. I'll kind of assume the question, and if I'm wrong, tell me and rephrase it. If you think that there's some kind of silver lining to this virus, I guess theoretically, if you really searched endlessly for one, you could say that maybe we'll treat health pandemics more sanely, and we'll prepare better, and we'll have better health policies for the nation, and not just kind of play it by ear. But aside from that, I don't know if you could really make any kind of silver lining for this. Sorry, someone just transmitted, and it was about 99% noise.
N1YDY with a question.
That's not good news, Roy. If anybody would know that I know, it would be you. So I guess that's pretty depressing. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
I wish I could tell you, Rich, that this is a wonderful thing to happen to us. I'm not that much of a crazy optimist. It is giving us a very, very painful lesson that we have to take public health measures seriously, that we can't wait until the hell happens before we start to make up plans. You know, the military has plans for everything. It's a shame we couldn't get them to have all kinds of contingency plans for our situation. But that's not how public health works, unfortunately. Hank, you had a question.
Yep, and good evening to everybody on the net. My question is, at one point I heard that the CDC budget for this type of activity, or research into this type of activity, had been cut recently. Is there any truth to that? And if that hadn't been the case, would that have left us in a better place, or are these two items completely unrelated?
Well, the executive branch doesn't seem to like public health issues. There were a lot of organizations, committees, there were staff that were set up in the White House proper by the Obama administration that were shut down and everyone was fired. They have repeatedly suggested budgets where the CDC gets less money. The Congress has been less prone to do that. You know, if the administration had gotten all their budget requests, then they'd even have less money. I don't think that this is inherently a money problem as much as it is a lack of some cohesive single person who kind of becomes the foreman for the team. You sort of need a leader to kind of push everything through. They have some very brilliant guys working there at the CDC, but they are not big on manufacturing. They don't run companies. They run labs. So if there was someone overseeing all this and could manage it and could then kind of bounce it over to either manufacturing, major medical labs and such, and speed it along. Unfortunately, the first 6 weeks was spent with happy talk that this will pass us, and it'll be like a miracle. So I think that's where we went terribly wrong.
Okay, thanks. And when why do I clear?
Casey.
Okay, a lot of noise on the repeater tonight. You want to repeat your call? Not about 95% noise. I don't know what's going on tonight.
KC2, SHO, comment.
Hey, John, yeah, sure.
That seemed cut off. Was that handed off to me? This is KC2, SHO with a comment.
Yes, John, please, feel free.
Okay, that's a double failure. I hope I'm coming through. This is KC2SHO with a comment. Sounds like maybe one of your repeaters there ID'd, and that comes across the RLP, which is a bit weird, but okay. Is it handed off to me? This is KC2SHO.
Yes, please, John. Feel free. You have the mic.
Well, at least that time the ID and your voice came along together. That's a problem for RLP to have the IDs coming across. I don't know if someone can do something about that. But anyway, I thought I heard it asked earlier, but I don't know if I heard the answer. If I understand it right, the structure of the coronavirus is called a capsid. How many does it take to infect an individual? Is it just one? Please elaborate on that.
I would imagine that all it would take is one. You know, they might look under electron microscopes and come up with a different conclusion. But with most viral phages, all it takes is one. It plants itself on the cell membrane surface and injects its RNA into the cell, and they start to manufacture there like little factories. So theoretically only one, but as I was mentioning earlier tonight, these things are basically surface and airborne. They're in droplets, and usually there's thousands upon thousands of viral particles in each droplet. So it's probably not unusual for more than one virus to attack a cell at a time under those circumstances.
Okay, real good. That's what I figured, but, you know, you hear a lot of people, if we just test everyone, you know, we can knock this thing out, but I think they're missing an important part of the puzzle that, you know, you can't test for just one. You have to wait for, if I have it right, please tell me, because I want to make sure I'm saying the right things, you know, not regurgitating garbage, which there seems to be a lot of, but you have to wait for this gestation period to happen, and then once there is a high enough count of these in your body, then the chances of finding it in a sample are much easier. Do I have it right? EC2GS, KC2SHO. I'll leave it to you for the final.
Okay, very good, John. Well, you pretty much have it right. There's a little nuance to it. Because it's mostly a respiratory virus, most of the viral particles are you're going to find in the nasopharynx, the mouth, and down the throat and the lungs. So what they're doing is they're sticking a cotton ball, a swab, all the way up people's nose, you know, where it almost feels like they're going to scratch the guy's brain. And they use that specimen of that discharge to do a immunoassay of the RNA pairs. China decoded the RNA sequence of the virus, so they're able to use that method. And if you only have a few viral particles, then yeah, the test is not going to show anything. You have to wait until you are manufacturing a significant portion that's above the sensitivity rating for the immunoassay. Anything further, John, on this?
No, that's good, Roy. That's exactly the kind of information I was looking for, you know. Sometimes you can read pages of information, but they don't really get down to the details of how that works, so I appreciate the explanation. Very good. And I hope lots of other people are listening and taking notes. I like the term that one of the news, an interview I heard where they were interviewing a doctor of some sort, I forget what his title was, but you know, what's happening now is only a snapshot of the infections that happened a week ago. You don't know what's happening now until next week. AC2, GSKC2, SHO. I'll be quiet after this.
AC2GS. Yeah, John. 2020 in hindsight is a great thing. You know, next year there'll probably be a great book written for epidemiologists with all the numbers finalized and complete physiological studies. We'll know absolutely everything that we'll ever want to know about. You know, when AIDS first came on, and I was just a medical student. I still remember I was at Kings County. We had these Haitian patients with these very strange skin cancers that previously were only known to afflict Mediterranean Jewish old men. And that was the very, very beginnings of HIV. We didn't have a clue, but now you can pick up a book and it'll tell you just about every little fact about how HIV works. It's amazing how science goes. So, yeah, it's we'll find out historically what's going on. We are unfortunately behind the curve, and we don't know which curve we're following yet. If we're lucky, we will be following either Korea or Japan or Taiwan. If you look at the curves, they peaked a little bit and then they went down. If we're unlucky, we're in Spain or Italy territory, which I hope we won't be. But it'll take time for us to be able to tell which curve we're riding on.
KC2VCP with a comment.
VCP.
Hi, yes. I enjoyed listening to this. This is very good. However, there was a couple of things that I didn't hear. I didn't hear the whole part, so I did have a couple of questions or comments. The thing that I'm concerned about, and while it's not about the biology of it, it's about what went on in China when this disease was starting, that the people that were trying to let people know about it were silent. So their free speech, quote-unquote, that we have here wasn't used. So we weren't able to get the information in a timely way. Let me drop. And then the truthfulness of what was told to us and the Chinese government preventing American doctors from going there is another thing about what kind of information we got regarding it. So for the way I see it, we didn't have good information to start with, so they had to work with what they got. But now we will be prepared for future epidemics because they clearly weren't prepared when they came in because nothing was set up by other administrations. But not only that, the guy wasn't fired, he quit. That's all I'm going to say because my blood is boiling. KC2VCT, clear.
On. Okay, I really don't want to get into a political talk. I usually joke that the political net is on at 12:07. I agree with you that the Chinese have been problematic from the very get-go. And I did a story earlier in this tale about a Chinese doctor who was hauled into the police department and made to sign a note promising not to tell people that there was a coronavirus that was killing people. And then he ended up going back to the hospital to work and he died of the coronavirus. So I am not a chum of the Chinese, but if you take a look at Korea, it's not like South Korea didn't have an in with China of giving the real facts. They seem to have prepared properly. They ramped up their testing so that hundreds of thousands of people have been tested over the last few weeks, and so I think two wrongs don't make a right.
Was their speed and size of their country any different than our speed and size?
No, their size is much smaller. Their speed was much faster, though. I mean, I'm not saying per capita test. I'm saying absolute numbers of testing. They've tested about 240,000 people. To our 13,000.
And their reason for testing so many, that may be what I don't understand. Were there all those people exposed, and why were so many people exposed?
most epidemiologists would test more than the people who were highly symptomatic. That's sort of what you do. In China, supposedly, they were testing millions upon millions of people. Now, I don't know if I believe that or not. I have nothing to base it on except what they say, and I don't really believe much of what they say. But all things being equal, if someone came to you and you said would you like 10,000 tests or 2 million tests, most people would go for the 2 million because it's important to know people who aren't even terribly symptomatic because then you can selectively isolate them and slow down the infection rate. So the more tests you do, the better, although that requires manufacturing large supplies of very esoteric testing equipment.
So where they said our equipment, because of the FDA regulations, you couldn't test things because they had to change the guidelines on the equipment. They had to change all policies. Yay, no?
One of the limitations with allowing third parties to do testing was the FDA regulations and no one who kind of could snip the red tape. But there are other problems as well. For a time, the CDC decided that they were going to produce their own purposes and not really look upon it as a larger than small frame manufacturing problem. So that's why there were 500 kits at first. Not to mention that unfortunately they fouled up the reagent so that the results were meaningless.
Okay, thank you very much. KC2, VCC clear.
Okay, very good. What can I tell you? It's no one person's fault. It's no 10 people's fault. It's not 10,000 people's fault. It's the world and bureaucracies and delays and confusion and politics and all kinds of nonsense. Anyway, David, KG2RY, you wanted to say something?
QSL. I saw a couple of different stories. One picture I saw of Chinese people coming out of the treatment and they're well. You know, they basically survived the virus. They felt the symptoms, they were treated. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that because they really don't say too much about the success rate of this treatment, go ahead.
Well, unfortunately, it's only supportive treatment. There's nothing that you can do. There's no antiviral that we have knowledge of at this point that we can use to fight this infection. So you're simply offering respiratory support for these people until their own immune system can fight it out. And again, if you want to believe their numbers, they're ridiculously low, which is great, wonderful. I hope it's true numbers, and I hope that when they start up their economy again and bring everyone back together, that it doesn't flare up and we see a double bump. But it's all supportive treatment at this point. There's no fundamental drug treatments available, and you're not going to see the horror stories. One of the horror stories was that I mentioned earlier that if you tested the positive, but you didn't require hospitalization, they would isolate you in old hotels that they locked down. And one of those hotels actually, and it was only, I think it was 1997 it was built, but because Chinese tend to remodel a lot of time, and they don't really build great buildings these days, it collapsed. And so a lot of the people who were in there because the government forced them because they were under isolation got injured from the building collapsing out from under them. So you're not going to hear those stories too much, but they happen as well. They do things good, they do things bad. It's a totalitarian country, and they don't have freedom of any speech, to my knowledge, and that's the way they like it. So I don't know what to tell you.
Roy, do you think it's a good idea for a person if they can, to avoid contact with people, to stay indoors and to just chill out for as long as necessary. People who have families, you know, that all stay together in one place, they don't go out, just to try to avoid being infected and somehow wait until the right time when they can emerge again. Go ahead.
KC2GS. Yeah, well, that's social isolation, and that's what everyone is trying to get people to understand. No one wants people to panic. No one wants people to run out to the supermarket and buy every last toilet roll there is. But also, no one wants people to think that it's a communist plot or something, and it really isn't there. They got to ride someplace in the middle of this strange zone. And so if you can limit your voluntary interaction with other people on a social level, that is a very good thing to do. If you are in a situation where you have to be someplace with other people, if you don't, you don't get paid. If you don't get paid, you don't eat, and you don't get, they throw you out of that, you don't pay the rent, whatever, then you're stuck. But if you're not stuck and, you know, any kind of optional activity for the time being, I would cancel. You know, curl up with a good book, watch television, listen to music, what have you. There's a lot of things that are somewhat antisocial, but they're safer than going out to a bar or such. So I would agree with you, David, that the social isolation would probably be very wise for just about everyone. You may still end up getting it down the road when the peak has popped and later on, but then it's much easier to deal with than it would be at the early part of this curve going up.
QSL, and I told somebody earlier today, I said, you know, just don't let people breathe on you. Don't let them breathe on you. They keep a distance, you know.
Well, again, the magic number that epidemiologists are telling people is to stay beyond 6 feet from anyone else. And certainly, you know, if you're going to cough or sneeze, do it into your elbow. Don't shake hands. Wash your hands regularly. Try not to put yourself in an environment that's filled with random people, you know, like the subway system. And I mean, it sounds antisocial, but I mean, it's not. It's just a health issue. This is a communicable disease, and you don't want to give the virus a one-up. So if you can possibly isolate you and your loved ones for the next few weeks until the dust settles and we see the peaks come and see the peaks go, that would probably be very wise on your part.
QSL, thank you, Dr. Roy, KG2RY.
KG2TDN, comment.
Please, comment.
Good evening, gentlemen. My name is Martin. It's excellent discussion here. I want to comment on one previous person who asked if there is a silver lining with this virus. My hope is that this nation and other nations learn to diversify from where they get equipment and medicine. KD2, TDL, clear.
Well, I hope you are quite right. I have seen people kind of do stupid things for so long that my gut sense is that this is not going to change anyone's practice. Ultimately, everyone's looking for the short-term fix. So they're looking for the lowest cost, and right now China is subsidizing everything, and so it's just cheap to get everything from them until the day they turn the spigot off or they pour poison into it. So I would agree with you. I hope we learn these mistakes that we've made, learn from them, and correct them. But I'm not as much of an optimist about policy. So we'll see what happens.
Question in one whitey way.
Yes, Hank.
I'm not asking in a professional capacity, but just shooting from the hip, how long do you think those of us that choose to self-isolate will need to do so?
That's a tough one. It depends on how the curve develops. I would say, and how optimistic or pessimistic I am as a human being, I would say easily for the next month, probably for 6 weeks. I'm just kind of taking it from the gut, if you will. We could have one big peak, we could have a flat, we could have a triple peak, we could have all kinds of different curves. But my gut sense is that we're about 2 weeks behind, say, Japan or Taiwan. So, kind of a mediocre look, I would say 6 weeks. But that's just a guesstimate on my part.
Okay, so if I... Well, just... That's good. Thank you very much. And one whitey white.
Okay, Hank. I mean, ultimately, none of this, even the stuff that I get off of epidemiological studies and all kinds of things, is written in stone. It's all subject to revision because early data is not necessarily the most accurate data. So, you know, the numbers might swap and change and go all over the place. But that's the sense of just what have you that I get out of this. I'm sure if you have some Harvard-trained epidemiologist, virologist, he would probably give you a different number. Just base it on the general announcements of different places of how many months that they're kind of saying that they're going to put everything on hold. You got kind of a sense for the time frame involved in this.
No, I understand. I have a story I'd like to relate if you have a moment.
Sure, Hank, please, share.
I think a lot of this is going to be based on how we behave as a society. And as you might recall, I used to work for the airlines, and I still have friends that do. And I heard one of them complaining the other day when he was telling me that there was a gentleman who got on one of their airplanes, and he had tested positive for this before he got on the plane and chose not to tell anyone until after they had already landed at their destination. And as long as you have folks behaving in that way, you know, it can lengthen the amount of time that we're all going to be exposed to this. And one whitey white.
I agree with you, Hank. There is a certain percentage of selfish people who don't care about the community, or they're just downright stupid, or vengeful, or a lot of other reasons. Even in totalitarian countries like China, where they were actually melting metal to keep them in their apartments. They were welding them shut. There are lots of videos online on YouTube of Chinese people scurrying under boundaries that are set up where they should have stayed where they are. People, unfortunately, the percentage of people, some people follow all the rules. Most of us follow most of the rules. Some of us follow none of the rules. So there's always enough people not following the rules, even in a doctrinaire state, but certainly not a free state like ours, where they'll screw it up for everyone else. So I completely believe that these people are going to screw it up for the rest of us, no matter what we do, to a degree. So I don't think that we can nip it in the bud, if you will. I think the cat's out of the bag. You know, locking down the country isn't going to really do much because it's here. We just have to slow it down a bit. That I think, is the best strategy at this point.
All right. Anyone, why do I clear?
AC2GS. Well, any further questions or comments about the coronavirus tonight, please feel free. No, I'm sorry. 100% noise. I can't even make out a voice in that. Okay, I kind of heard 30% of that, so I'll just assume that it's what I think it is, where the question was about a viable vaccine. They're working very, very hard. They've been working very, very hard for at least a month. It's sort of initially based upon the old SARS virus that they were working for vaccines on, so they kind of switched gears and took the new information from China and started work on this this vaccination scheme. At that time, about a month or so ago, they were suggesting that it would be ready for preliminary testing in 3 months. Unless someone really fast speeds the process, as Anthony Fauci, one of the big guys running this all, has mentioned, it's going to take at least a year and a half to gear up any significant production of a viable vaccine, if we're very lucky, if this particular combination works and is safe. And if it isn't, then it obviously takes longer because they have to go back to the kitchen.
The AP announced that the first person is going to be trial tomorrow in Seattle is the first vaccine trial. Have started, so quicker than 3 months.
Okay, very good. I hope it works. I wish them all the luck in the world. Unfortunately, again, the requirements usually to go from initial testing to mass production tends to take a lot of time, but, you know, maybe they can fast-track it. We'll see. I hope for the best, and we'll see what happens. But, you know, you can't rely on these things. You can hope for them, but you can't rely on them.
KG2RY.
Yes, David.
I saw an article that some Israeli doctors or researchers or they say that they can create a vaccine in 3 months.
Well, even the people who are working on it in this country said that if they're lucky, they could create it in 3 months. So the problem is not necessarily how long it takes to, quote, create it, but in order to go through the things you have to do to make sure that it doesn't make people sick and then gear up millions and millions of samples to vaccinate people. So, you know, it starts with 3 months in the development, and then it's not the development that's the slowest part, unless, of course, the development fails. You know, they do it for 3 months, and they test it, and they find out that it kills someone, and they have to go back to the kitchen. But it's the entire chain of events that usually has to go through before anyone will approve massive vaccination of people. I mean, you get the nonsense of autism, where, you know, people are convinced not to vaccinate their children, and there's absolutely endless studies that demonstrate no risk whatsoever, as opposed to a new vaccine that just came off the on the market an hour and a half ago. You never quite know what it's going to do.
QSL. But the process of making, you know, creating a vaccination and the mass producing of it and the marketing of it and all that, is it different if this happens in another country as opposed to here in the United States?
Well, theoretically, yes. If you have a country that doesn't care, you know, they have no lawyers, no one gets sued, no businesses go out, go broke, and you can just give it to people, all of your people, and if some of them die or something, well, you just shrug your shoulders and say, we tried, didn't we? If you're a crazy country, you can go for 3 months to whatever then is the gearing up of manufacturing. I don't know, I'm not a vaccine manufacturer, so I don't know what that would entail. How